Bonjour et bienvenue à It's a Wonderful Podcast. That is all the French you are getting from me today. Not our world cinema series is continuing on It's a Wonderful Podcast this week. We are back in France. It's been a little while since we've been in France on the main show, Janine, but it has been in the past a particularly notable location.
Yes.
One movie, I would say, in particular, from the past of It's a Wonderful Podcast. And I now can't think, actually, if we have covered any others. Although I want to say we have, but now I've forgotten.
I feel like the only one really was Paris Blues, right?
Well, Paris Blues isn't a French movie, but it certainly is Paris. That makes sense. Maybe I'm thinking about Paris Blues. I was thinking La Belle.
La Bête, yes. A beautiful movie, yes.
Which is definitely a French movie, and I know for a fact was the first French movie ever covered on It's a Wonderful Podcast. So we're not in the same situation we were in last week when we were in Italy with Fellini's 8.5, which was the first Italian movie ever covered on It's a Wonderful Podcast. Of course, go and listen to that episode if you haven't already, but it's nice to be back in France. Yeah. We are, of course, in the world of the French New Wave, every film class's favourite era of movies, because film classes like to feel themselves considerably more important than everybody else, don't they? And they might have that slight hoity-toity nature about them. And I think this movie today perhaps has that reputation, although why it quite has that reputation, I've got no idea. Simply, I suppose, for being a rather game-changing, stylish movie, because it certainly isn't full of itself. It certainly isn't this grand pontification on the philosophy of life and all these kind of high concepts that you may think about when you think of, film as cinema and all these quotes that you get sometimes that make me feel at times like I want to throw up, but also make me feel at times like I understand what you mean. I do understand what you mean.
Yeah, but I think it's more the idea of these films than the films themselves, that you go into a new wave French film from the 60s and you immediately have this kind of art house, snobbish, international, elevated idea of it and think the movie has that idea of itself.
And as we love to do on It's a Wonderful Podcast, we make old movies accessible to everybody here. Not that this movie, which is, of course, Breathless, Jean-Luc Godard's Breathless from 1960, or A Bout de Souffle, to use its French. Oh, I've given you more French there now.
Yes.
I've actually lied in my introduction to today's episode. I've given you more French, but that is its French title. It does have that reputation, I think, as being a favourite of film classes everywhere. And therefore perhaps a certain snobbish variety of movie lovers take to a movie like Breathless more than most, which it's good to like movies. Of course, it's good to like movies. I just think we on It's a Wonderful Podcast live in the world of do not gatekeep movies.
Yes.
The movies are for every movie is for everybody.
Yeah.
It's just finding them. And that's why we're here talking about a world of movies that we are talking about all month long here on the main show. But this was a first time watch of Breathless for me. I found it very, very interesting. I mean, it's much less thinky than 8.5 from last week. It is
definitely
really a rather straightforward movie, a rather straightforward story. But all of its interest comes in its style, in its filmmaking aspects, in its technical aspects, which, again, I suppose is why it's a favourite of film classes because it is there to kind of, you can dissect filmmaking techniques from watching Breathless very, very easily, because it's very easy to tell what isn't there that's usually there when you're watching movies.
Yeah.
So you can kind of realize what you can play around with, what you can creatively play around with when you're actually making a movie, if you are making a movie. It's very, very interesting from that standpoint, but it's actually got a really quite bizarrely unintentional story around it actually ending up being the revered classic, I suppose, that it is of its time, and this symbol of a rebellious new phase in movie making across the world, which it very much is. I mean, it didn't begin the French New Wave as a wave, as an era of movies, but it certainly symbolized it more than the few movies that came before it. I think that mainly has to do with the fact that every one of the three main people involved in that era of movies, Jean-Luc Godard, who directed this movie, François Truffaut, and Claude Chabrol, who had directed what you would consider French New Wave movies in the late 50s, 1959, one of which we'll be covering as at the end of this series, this World Cinema series, with Truffaut's The 400 Blows. But all three of those people are involved in Breathless. Godard directed it, Truffaut and Chabrol. I think it comes from a story from Chabrol, and Truffaut wrote the script for, or helped write the story for, this particular movie. So it is really that collaborative new wave effort from all three that I think solidifies Breathless as the real turning point in realizing that you're in a new era of movies in European cinema, I suppose, if you want to call it like that. But enough nonsense from me, Janine, because I can, you know, basically tell you about the fact we're in the French New Wave as much as I want to. What did you think about this movie?
It was very cool. Like, I think after last week, I was definitely expecting, I think, you know, I went into this film myself with that type of prejudice that I mentioned, this kind of art house, international new wave, 60s French, kind of, you know, this movie, really thinking highly of itself to kind of strike this really elevated vibe. But when I ended up watching it and having this really cool, chilled out plot and essence, it kind of took me aback a little bit, and I was into it. I appreciated that it wasn't heavy-handed with the plot. Again, especially I think after last week was very heady and introspective and thoughtful. This film was just like, lay back and see this character who literally tells you who he is up front, just kind of go through these few days with as little thought or care to what is happening around him as possible, was just kind of an interesting kind of come down from the extravaganza of our first film in the series.
It has been an interesting kind of 1-2 punch we've had. I think neither movie, I think we said as much last week when we were speaking about 8.5, a movie that could have very easily felt like it was up itself.
Yeah.
Never, ever comes across that way.
No, it doesn't.
At all. It's too cool. It's too creative. It's too interesting to ever feel, and it's too self-aware to ever feel like it's snobbish. And Breathless, in a way, is very similar to that. It is an example of a filmmaker making the first movie for absolutely, you know, for nothing, really. I mean, Godard was a critic and just a movie fan who wanted to make a movie.
Yeah.
And did in this ridiculously on-the-ground kind of in-your-face way that's not really, you know, there was shooting things here. They didn't have legal permission to shoot on the streets of Paris and all that kind of thing. So yeah, they're just shooting with this, with a tiny, you know, new phase handheld camera that obviously hadn't been around for very long at all. This is 1960, yeah, we're talking about, or, you know, probably when it's being made, 59. So you are really changing technologically in the way movies can look as well, which I think brings that freshness that, yeah, you feel with Breathless, brings that new style, as well as being very aloof and very kind of very cooler than cool, as you said, yeah, before, because it isn't, it isn't really concerned with what's happening in it. It just wants to almost depict an atmosphere, depict a vibe, really. Yeah. And it does that really, really quite well. And it is interesting to look at because you realize that it's really taking everything that you know about the most mainstream of Hollywood movies from before this time, just before from this time leading up to the 60s, and completely doing everything opposite to what you're used to seeing.
Yeah.
And I think because we are more used to seeing unorthodox styles of filmmaking now, we're more used to seeing so many things that have been heavily influenced by something like Breathless and other movies in the French New Wave era, that it can, you know, I don't want it to be lost on us that this is actually really, really very, very fresh. This is something very, very, yeah, different to what even movies in France and in other parts of Europe are doing at this time. You don't get a movie that is this in your face, that is this on the ground documentary style in a way. Because, yeah, it's not a documentary, obviously, but it feels like you are running around the streets of Paris because you are simply running around the streets of Paris.
Yeah, 100%.
And with a main character whose first line in the movie is, "I'm an asshole, I know that," and, yeah, then proceeds to show us exactly why he believes that of himself over the next, yeah, 90 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, he's not necessarily a very likable person, Michel, but Jean-Paul Belmondo brings so much magnetism to him. I don't think you can take your eyes off him. You're quite fascinated by him. He's unpredictable. You don't really know what he's going to do next. It's like the movie's quite unpredictable because, you know, it's filled with all these jump cut moments and occasional fourth wall breaks, even,
yeah,
and just very, very interesting, different creative inputs that, you know, mirror what's going on, I suppose, in its rather simple story as well. But I mean, before we do get into more discussion on this, I know we have talked now for 15 minutes or so as an introduction, but we do have to say a big thank you to all our patrons today.
Yes.
It's a wonderful podcast. We love doing that all the time. We love our patrons dearly. We wouldn't be able to do what we do here without their generous, delightful support. And if you would like to join them and join us on the Patreon, support us in that way, or just donate in any way as well, there are links in the description of this episode to go and do that. Janine, would you like to start us off?
I would love to, with a huge thank you to Adam Witt.
And thank you to Michael Smith.
Thank you, Abby Friel.
Thank you, Faraz Muthana.
Thank you, Tina Farrow.
Thank you to Marcus Burton.
Thank you to Movie Fanobi Steve.
Thank you, Samir Tesfai.
Thank you, Patrick Harden.
Thank you to Carla Feese.
Thank you to the great Ken Knapsack.
Thank you to Tom and Kimber of the Odd Shape Channel.
Thank you, Eric Garcia.
And thank you, of course, to Billy Polahan.
Yay!
Yes. Stop me from talking about the stylistic implements of the movie.
I mean,
and speak about them and your own feelings towards them yourself.
Yes, I mean, as you said, the film opens with this guy telling us he's an asshole, then we proceed to watch him be an asshole for like an hour and a half, just kind of going about his day. He is very just reckless and really has no regard for what he's done or how he treats people. So we're following somebody who is not inherently likable. And, you know, no. I think that's always an interesting take, because I think the default is to have a protagonist that we like and that we root for. But we're not really rooting for this guy at all. And I think the film makes that clear, especially with that opening line, that that's not really the point, that he's just a person who is showing us this air that he has about him. And I'm also kind of wondering if there's this, was this purposeful tie to an American kind of inspiration or tone, for the fact that not only is the kind of woman that he latches himself onto through the course of the film is an American living in Paris, but also we see him immediately kind of set up that the character, the embodiment that really is inspiring this person that he wants to be on this day, is Humphrey Bogart, a very popular American actor. So yeah. I'm wondering if that was a purposeful kind of attitude or tone that the film wanted to strike, taking inspiration from American film or kind of the culture from American cinema going into the 60s.
Yeah, I mean, he's doing a fairly bad job of behaving like Bogart, apart from the fact that, yeah, okay, he smokes an awful lot.
Yes, and he has this aloof kind of attitude, which I think comes across with, you know, Bogart is usually very understated. He's not very animated. He has this very kind of cool, mellow air about him. And so I think that's maybe what he's trying to strike, particularly even when things get very hairy for him, he's still seemingly like, I don't care kind of thing.
Yeah. And I suppose that's a very, very good point, actually. But while Bogart may tend to be like that in his movies, I mean, sometimes it's a little bit more interesting, as we well know with movies we've covered on this show, that it can be more interesting to see Bogart actually not be in control.
Yes, losing it a little bit.
Mm-hmm. But most of the time, obviously, he tends to be the most in control person in the room, very, very sure of himself. And it's easy to see why somebody like Michelle, who is ultimately kind of this lost soul kind of character, he's a thief. The movie opens really quite quickly with this "I'm an asshole, I know I am" moment. He steals a car and then gets into a little bit of a police chase where you get a bit of a fourth wall break. You start with the jump cut situation that Breathless is very, very famous for, and then he murders one of the police officers
that are chasing
coming after him. And the rest of the movie is him not caring that he's on the run from the police, while trying to convince his, you know, love, played by Gene Seberg, Patricia in the movie, to move to Italy with him, even though he's known her for like only a short while when they were on holiday in Nice, and they constantly talk about the fact that, oh no, we've only seen each other three times, we've only slept together twice, three times, or something like that. I can't begin this whole life with you. But he has this idealistic impression of her. She herself, I think, is a little bit idealistic, or maybe she's just idealized, and the movie kind of paints her in this angelic, perfect kind of way as a romantic partner to strive for, because it kind of puts us in Michelle's. I keep calling him Michelle, and that Michelle.
Michelle.
It's French.
Yeah.
In Michelle's point of view, but because he is somebody that seems to not really be aware of how serious some situations is, or at least not focus on how serious some situations are, then it almost makes the romance immediately kind of doomed, because you know they're never quite going to be on the same level. Even though we spend really quite a lot of time with the two of them, it's the heart of the movie, absolutely. Yeah. And there's a 20-minute kind of period in the middle of the movie when you are just with the two of them. There's none of the crazy jump cutting around and going on the lam and the police after your business. No, they're just in their, or in her apartment, kind of just hanging out, chilling out, doing a bit of flirting, doing a bit of kissing, listening to some music. And, you know, talking about life and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, and she randomly tells him that she might be pregnant with his child.
She does. There's a dryness, I think, to Breathless as well that really comes across. It's interesting from a character point as well, though, because of what I've been saying, he is somebody that may mold himself off of the image of Bogart and dress a bit like Bogart. Yes, he's in a suit. He's wearing a floppy hat over one eye and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But if he thinks he's Bogart, he's more lost than he even comes across.
Yeah, you feel like he has this cool aloofness about him, but you can tell he's incredibly lost. Like, he doesn't know who he is. That's why he has to kind of put on this costume. And even when he's wearing this costume, we don't feel it, because typically we like Humphrey Bogart in the roles he is. When we're following him, we're on his side. And we're never really on his side. So we know it's just this immature kind of little boy playing dress up in a way. When he feels like he's losing control, he starts insulting, you know, this girl that he's with. And then he'll try to immediately charm her again with compliments and things. So you feel this kind of like, you know, the once it's out and the police are looking for him, this kind of chase is on. We'll cut to like scenes of the police kind of inquiring about him, looking for him. There's a point where he even opens up a paper and like big, huge picture of him in the paper saying that he killed this cop. And he really still just kind of going about his routine, kind of running around town, not really caring.
The man who owes him some money.
Yes, he has no really strong reaction to this big ad in the paper about him, you know, committing this crime. And he's still just playing it off like he doesn't care. So we never truly believe this persona, this identity that he's trying to put on. So we can never really get on his side, even though he's told us who he is from the start. You know, we still have those anti-hero protagonists who we know aren't good people, but we can still kind of root for. And he definitely is not that. And I think that is incredibly interesting that the film was just like, this is who this guy is. See him how you choose, you know?
Yeah, because it's very easy to see him as stunningly immature and kind of thoughtless.
Yeah.
He's older than Patricia in the movie. You know, Michelle is older than Patricia. I think Patricia's only supposed to be about 20. But yet she comes across as so much more mature, so much more figured out in herself. She's, I think, she's a reporter, a journalist. She's working for the New York Herald Tribune office in Paris, and seems to have a really quite comfortable life in France, you know, for being a young kind of student.
Yeah.
Who doesn't really want to be derailed by Michelle, but does have this kind of indescribable attraction towards him. And it's what makes a certain, I don't know whether you want to go as far as calling it a betrayal that happens later on in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, whether you want to go that far and call it that. But it's what makes that particular moment, I think, heartbreakingly work, or work heartbreakingly.
Yeah.
Because you do feel that there's an affection from Patricia as well. There's an obvious desire from Michelle, because he's constantly trying to flirt with her and then be nasty to her and then flirt with her again and then be inappropriate and then get slapped and then try it on again. And he's doing all this
weird cycle of
doing the same thing over and over and over again and never really getting anywhere with it. And yes, that comes across as very immature. Like we say, though, at times he can come across as quite cool, but I think that might be more Jean-Paul Belmondo who's playing him than Michelle giving himself. That up.
Yes, and I think also she also has somebody else who I think he's like a director who's interested in her as well. So I think they try to, because I think you would be questioning, why did she like him? Like, why would she even entertain him, keep him at, you know, her apartment? She covers for him once she learns the truth for a decent amount of time before the quote unquote betrayal. So we're all just kind of wondering as viewers, what is she seeing in him that she is not telling him to get the hell out of here? And I think they juxtapose this also other potential romance with somebody she works with and him maybe being kind of boring. So when you compare that to this young, idealistic American girl in another country, to this, you know, cool, aloof Frenchman, he looks far more interesting and exciting juxtaposed next to this kind of normal director guy.
Yeah.
So I think they do that to really give us some sense of understanding as to why she would even entertain Michelle to any degree, considering how just deplorable he is.
I mean, it's interesting to think about it like this, actually, and talking about it in this episode has made me think about this. But is the movie itself acting as this kind of wannabe free spirit, yet knows itself it can't quite go that far?
Because
ultimately that's what ends up happening to Michelle. He tries to be too above it all. He tries to be too free-spirited. He tries to not care about anything, and it catches up to him. Eventually, it catches up to him. The police catch up to him. They get in touch with Patricia. They kind of threaten Patricia with almost pretty much deportation if they don't, you know.
If she doesn't help them find him.
If she doesn't help them find him, because they've been seen together. Funnily enough, the guy who informs the police that Michelle and Patricia were together, because I think it's when this newspaper's just come out and and you see a guy in dark sunglasses go over to the police. That is Jean-Luc Godard. That is he is played by Jean-Luc Godard. Interestingly as well, there's supposed to be a novelist that appears in a press conference that Patricia goes to.
Yeah.
Two-thirds of the way through the movie. He's played by Jean-Pierre Melville, who's another famous French director of the era. So there's a lot of, I think, collaboration between the contemporary French filmmakers of the time within Breathless. I think they it's almost like a little club.
Yeah. And when you brought up that kind of press conference scene, I think that also plays into what I was talking about why she finds Michel so interesting, despite kind of how terrible he is. Also, she seems to be somebody who kind of likes that attention. She likes that male attention. And in this press conference scene, the guy that they're interviewing, he is kind of flirting with her and saying these complimentary things for her. And we just see her kind of shyly, coyly smile. And you can tell she's enjoying him making these comments to her. So I think
you wonder where these stereotypes of French people come from. And then you realize that the French just put them on themselves, don't they?
Exactly. Exactly. This kind of very flirtatious energy. And so I think when Michel comes around and he's telling her he's going to whisk her away to Italy and all of these things, she likes that. She kind of probably knows that he's not a good person and that he's probably just using her. But she likes the attention. She likes when he seems a little bit jealous when she talks about this other guy she's seeing. You know, this guy that she's interviewing is flirting with her and she's kind of giggling to herself. So I think on top of her, you know, seeing Michel is exciting and interesting compared to the other guys that she's around, she also just likes that male attention and how it makes her feel. Yeah. So I mean, when he gives that to her, it's also kind of intoxicating and maybe blinds her for a little bit to who he really is and his really ultimate motivations.
Yeah, and yeah, it's what makes the, I suppose you could call it, ratting him out that she does or force it. No, it's not. It's helping the police catch a criminal. Let's put a good phrase on it, helping the police catch a criminal that she does toward the end of the movie. You know, it's what makes it really mean something to the emotional core of the movie, because you almost want them to have been able to run off to Italy together on Michel's fourth or fifth stolen car of the movie, or whatever it may be. But you know, ultimately, it's not going to happen, and Michel ends the movie and ends up kind of getting shot and stumbling down a street, dying in surrounded by Patricia, in Patricia's arms, surrounded by the police. I love
uses his last breath to say this terrible thing to her, which is something he said earlier as well. And it's like she doesn't understand. She doesn't understand the translation, and it just ends with her like, what did he just say to me?
He constantly, I mean, we see it in the subtitles, obviously, but he goes around calling people a louse all the time. And he's the biggest louse in this whole movie. It perfectly shows his warped mentality. With his final dying breath, the one person he seemingly had some sort of genuine heartfelt connection with, because we even see him with all the women at the beginning of the movie, don't we?
Yes.
And there's not this level of affection with these other women that there is with Patricia, with Jean Seberg. But he uses his dying breath to call her a louse again.
And tell her that she makes him want to puke. And she's like, puke? Yeah. What is puke? Like, she doesn't know. She's like, what did he say? And then the cops translate for her. And then she's like, what does puke mean?
It's this harsh, but realistic ending. It strips away the idealism that was present in the movie, and it almost it might mature itself, or it might become kind of more aware at that point. And this is where my thought of the movie itself being a little idealistic, a little in its making. I mean, you know, it doing these new things, feeling fresh, but ultimately, is it going to work? Does this really work if we go to this level with it? Do we have to kind of tone it back a bit? And this is where this really interesting story about its stylistic influence comes in, is because they made Breathless, and I think it was about 2.5 hours long, 2.25 hours long or something like that,
yeah,
as a movie. And it wasn't, nobody wanted to release it at that length. Cut it down to 90 minutes, please, yeah. Jean-Luc, is what they said. And what do you usually do when you're told to do that sort of thing is you cut scenes out of a movie and you just tighten up the movie.
Yeah.
A bit. Make you know, the story really tight, and cut unnecessary scenes. Well, Godard didn't want to do that, so he just cuts little bits out of every scene, which is what gives it the weird jump cut quality all the time. And makes the, say, in a conversation, you have the shot of the one person on the right of the screen, the shot of the one person on the left of the screen, call it shot, reverse shot. You never have the reverse shot. You just see the entire conversation
from that one perspective, yeah.
One perspective, one angle, jump cutting through the conversation.
Yeah.
For time reasons. Now, it works really well to create this quite erratic movie that is dynamic. It's like I said, it's kind of on the edge, it's in your face, it's all these kind of showy things and cool new stylish things.
Yeah.
But it's only that really because it was forced to be that. Maybe not, yes, because it actually creatively wanted to be that.
Yes,
it was
just, which also,
when they were told,
yeah,
you're not going to get this movie out, Jean-Luc Godard,
too
if
long,
you don't
yeah.
do this. And then he's thought, what I'll do is this version instead, because this is something new. So, yes, I mean, we can't not say Godard was being creatively, you know, intuitive there.
Purposeful.
And done something. Yeah. Deliberate, but he was forced to do it.
Yes, but even how he handled that situation, it felt like, you know, these quick erratic cuts just feel like the no care aloofness of the film.
Exactly.
and the lead character. So despite whether that being
thing.
Yeah, despite that, whether it was on purpose or not, how he chose to handle that criticism, you know, the way he just kind of cut things out kind of willy-nilly like that just feels very much like the no care attitude of our leading character.
Yeah.
So it's kind of this really interesting parallel.
It is. And it's whether you want to be idealistic in your view of Breathless yourself as to whether you view all these interesting creative implements as purposeful,
yeah,
or completely accidental.
Yeah.
Because they might be. They might be. We're not Jean-Luc Godard. Jean-Luc Godard, unfortunately, is no longer with us. He did only die a couple of years ago.
Oh, okay.
I think in his early 90s. But I think only after a year after Jean-Paul Belmondo, actually, as well. I think it's only reasonably recently passed away. But it's whether you want to actually, do you want to be a pessimist and view this movie as an accidental influence, or
yeah,
do you want to be optimistic and give Godard the benefit of the doubt? Because he is a filmmaker that has, not just with Breathless, but gone on to make other highly respected movies, greatly influential movies, Band Apart being one of them, but I don't think we can necessarily call it accidental. I think we can call it fortunate,
yes,
but not accidental.
Under the circumstances, you know, a choice made to do something interesting with something that he maybe didn't really want to do. So I might as well, you know, do something clever or interesting or fun with it if I'm going to do this thing that I really don't want to do.
Yeah, really quite fortunate as well, given he was even able, can't speak today, to get Gene Seberg to be in this movie, because Jean-Paul Belmondo was virtually unknown at this point. This was his breakthrough movie, and he became an enormous star in France and Europe, like massive. There is in Cannes, if you go to Cannes, I went to Cannes, not to the actual film festival, unfortunately, but actually to Cannes quite a few years ago now. That was actually, God, that was in 2016. That was 8 years ago. Oh, that's dang. Terrifying. What is time, Janine?
Right.
but like they have at the Chinese Theatre in LA, they have all the hand and footprints. And they have a bunch of hand and footprints in Cannes outside the main cinema, you know, where they do all the big premieres in Cannes. And these two are there. Jean-Paul Belmondo and Gene Seberg have their hand and footprints in there. Belmondo was a massive, massive star in France, thanks to this movie. And I think you can see why, because he does embody a real rebellious attitude
that
the 60s had across the Western world, didn't it? It was fight back against the status quo. And the movie really does do that. And going back onto the idealism with Bogart attitude that he has, that Michel has, does the movie not, while wanting to rebel, also have this idealistic attitude towards those mainstream Hollywood movies that it is trying to be the total opposite of, because it's showing them respect by doing everything totally different and wanting to be fresh in that way? It recognizes, it's not trying to be a pale comparison.
Yeah.
And I think that's always a great it's a great compliment to anything, to not just try and be a poor imitation of something,
to take the essence of something and make it your own, but you're still very much respectful and honoring that thing that you're looking to.
Yeah, and I think Breathless really does do that, because it does the total opposite of what mainstream Hollywood movies do stylistically.
Yeah.
And I think it's great for that. But look, it's not a complex movie.
No.
It's a
like you told me, it was kind of like this on the run movie. And so then when I see like this guy and this girl on the poster, and I'm thinking, okay, is this going to be this kind of Bonnie and Clyde on the run movie? And when it was just kind of this cool guy, just, you know, I'm going to steal this car, I'm going to kill this cop, I'm going to, you know, I think that's where he does have his fourth wall break, when he is kind of talking to us, like, if you don't like the mountains, if you don't like the ocean, you know, if you don't like the country, like, don't tell me about it, because I don't care kind of attitude. Like, the setup of this character already to just be this kind of unlikable person, I think, is so well done. And then, you know, when he does get in this chase with these police, I'm thinking, okay, we're really kicking off this on the run kind of story. He kills the cop. And then when I think it's really going to ramp up into this kind of cat and mouse game, it's just him strolling around the city, you know, meeting up with his ladies, stealing money from this one, charming this other one, making these grand plans, trying to catch up to this guy who owes him money, like just stealing random cars and, you know, getting into these little confrontations with people, seeing himself in the newspaper as, you know, this criminal and people looking for him, and him just closing the paper like, okay, whatever, smoking cigarettes. Like, so definitely just was had this whole idea of what to expect. Like I said, I did think I had this. And I think throughout this series, I'm probably going to have this stigma of, you know, international cinema from an earlier age feeling like this high art kind of wannabe thing, you know, that you, that people in wearing berets and, you know,
there's no berets in the movie.
I know. Well, no, like people like these art house kind of caricatures with goatees and, you know.
Oh, you mean the people watching the movie?
Yes.
Yes.
Like to surmise and discuss and have this air about. So I think like every film that we're going to talk about in this series, I'm probably going to go into it with this type of prejudice. And then so that on top of you kind of giving me this kind of cliff note of On the Run, the fact that this movie was completely none of that was just really a nice, refreshing surprise.
Yeah.
That it was literally just seeing this guy who doesn't care really being this rebel and being this kind of child almost putting on a costume of cool. And so I really, despite not liking the character, I liked following him because I was really like interested to see what he was going to do and how it was going to escalate, because it must escalate. Like, how are these things and this attitude he has going to ultimately catch up with him? So that's what really kept me intrigued into, like, how, what is he going to do next with this attitude in the situation he's in? How can he be so cool, calm, and collected in this situation? How does he think any of this is Bogard? Like, why does he think being like this is him being the hero of his own story when he's really just, you know, he's aware that he's an asshole, but he's also trying to be this almost hero, all-American figure in film. So this weird kind of way he sees himself is really what was pulling me in and really keeping me interested into, like, okay, what is going to happen next with this guy? How is he going to figure this out? Does he even care what happens next?
Yeah, and no, ultimately, I don't think he does. And as I've brought up during the episode, I think the same can be said for Goddard himself making this movie, because it was a first movie. He didn't really know how to make a movie. He's trying different things, but he's also not letting people kind of tell him what he should be doing.
Yeah, he doesn't care. He's being a bit of a rebel himself in making this movie and doing what he's doing, especially not having this like inherently deep plot. You're just following a really interesting character, and that was kind of enough for him to rebel against some kind of intense plotty story.
Yeah, he's almost a mirror for Michel, very spontaneous. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the script itself is written, you know, it's one of these situations where the scene is written the morning of it being shot in the afternoon and those kind of things. It's not really fully completed. It's a little bit like Guido from 8 and a Half, where he doesn't quite know what he's doing,
where it's going.
He just has to do it on the fly, quite interestingly. But it completely intrigues you and completely fascinates you to think of how something like Breathless comes about, results in what it results in, and inspires so much that comes after it from none more so than somebody like Tarantino in the absolute mainstream, who adores people just lounging around and talking about nothing to each other for 20 minutes and somehow making it the most captivating part of the
relatable entire movie. Yeah,
which is exactly what happens in Breathless. That 20 minutes in the middle of the movie is 100% the best part of the movie.
Just talking about music and you know, him trying to get in her pants. You know, people like this. So, you know, it feels very just chill and relatable and not trying to be anything groundbreaking, just really tapping into what people know and what people can relate to.
Yet it ends up being groundbreaking. Yet yeah. it ends up being totally fresh and mm-hmm. entirely influential for all these movie makers that have come since, that have looked on Breathless and other French New Wave movies with that have this similar rebellious nature to them, similar kind of in your face, on the ground, in the mix of it all, feel to them, style to them, creative flair to them, going against what came before, experimenting, trying new things. It's all present in Breathless, and it gives those filmmakers that came after so much belief in themselves, yeah. I think, that they can do this kind of thing. They can pay homage while putting their own little spin, little creative spin on things themselves, because it might just work. It kind of worked for Godard.
Yeah.
It made a star out of his lead in this movie. Jean Seberg, by the way, I was saying before how Godard was quite lucky to get her in the movie, because she, I think, a couple of years before had starred as Joan of Arc in Otto Preminger's Joan of Arc movie.
Oh, okay.
Which I don't think was massively successful. You know, as far as Otto Preminger movies go, he made some phenomenally successful movies, and I don't think his Joan of Arc movies
was one,
up there on anybody's list of Preminger yeah. movies, but Anatomy of a Murder, Laura, these other kind of things would be up there on Preminger movie lists, I think. But she was, you know, of a decent size as a name at the yeah. time, for a first time director to get that sort of thing in a new country as well. And yes, she can clearly speak French, as we find out in this movie.
Yeah.
But it's significant. It's significant. I think a lot of things fell in the right way for yeah. Godard eventually making this movie. But sometimes it takes a little bit of luck and a little bit of skill merged into one to create something that is very, very memorable. I yeah. think that's exactly the kind of situation we have with Breathless. I really enjoyed it as a first time watch.
Yeah.
And I might be a bit surprising that it's the first time I've watched this movie. Having actually been part of a film class, I think it's very surprising. it's my first time watching this
yes.
movie. I do think it's shown in every film class ever across the world at all times. There was definitely a poster of Breathless
in your film class, of course.
That I was in. Definitely a poster, because I remember seeing it. But we never really talked about it. It's clear to see why it's a film class favourite, as we've said. And I found it just very, very interesting. I would, I think, sooner go back and watch 8.5, but that's because I just think 8.5 has so many layers to it, and is made. I mean, it's not a debut movie. It says so in the title. I know we shouldn't be bringing up 8.5, but I like this, that this series is
surprise.
An exploration
yeah.
of things going on all around the world. I would like next week, when we travel to Japan for Tokyo Story,
yeah.
to bring conversations on this movie into that, and on 8.5 into that, because that's going to be something that's stylistically so different from
yeah.
both of those movies. Tokyo Story is, again, it's going to be a first-time watch for both of us, but it's a movie that is known to be incredibly stationary with its camera, but also have this very, very precise blocking to it
yeah.
and the complete disregard for what you call the 180-degree rule, where you as the viewer always stay on the same side of the scene. So the person on the left looking right is always the person on the left looking right, and vice versa. That doesn't exist in Tokyo Story.
No, it seems like you're going to be the one having the conversation looking to that person kind of thing.
Yeah, a lot of the time, or you just kind of move around this room. You're almost sat as a person as within the room of these people. In Tokyo Story, which is very, very interesting, and I'm looking forward to that. But yeah, totally different to something like Breathless. I like the thought of merging the entire series into ultimately one discussion, exploring all the different kinds of movies from across the world. And obviously they're very famous movies.
Yes.
Very well respected movies, but it's going to continue to be quite the journey,
I think,
and I like it. Do you have anything else you want to say about Breathless? A bout de souffle, Janine.
Yeah, just a very interesting vibe, a very rebellious kind of feeling film, and it's in its simplicity. It was kind of, as 8.5, bringing up again, was a surprise in just being this fever dream kind of lush, creative journey. This film in its simplicity was also a surprise, and somehow still feeling very kind of on the edge for being just a straightforward story. I was really into that, so.
I remembered that's what I was saying, actually. Breathless is a debut movie. 8.5 is literally someone's 8.5
film.
So it is a... I mean, whether you can call it even a far more competently made movie, maybe
or
not
ambitious,
fair because...
Maybe.
Well, it may not be fair because isn't this... exactly what Godard ended up intending for this movie
that's
anyway.
What he wanted. Yeah.
It's rough and ready, and it's supposed to be rough and ready.
Yeah.
But 8.5 doesn't break any technique rules at all. It breaks all kinds of creative rules.
Visual,
And narrative rules.
Yeah.
And visual rules, sure. 100%. Throwing all these philosophical ideas. You've never seen anything quite as uniquely creative in your entire life. But from an actual filmmaking standpoint, it's just solid. It is just there. It's so... You don't even think about the actual filmmaking of it because you're too interested in the brain being creative enough to impart that visually onto the screen. What Breathless does is forget all about that in creative story, make a really simple story, and use all its creativity in its technique.
Yeah.
Totally different. Very interesting. I like it a lot. Vive la France, Janine. We will be back, as we've said, for the 400 Blows, which will end our world cinema series here on It's a Wonderful Podcast. So keep an eye out for that. As we've said, we're going to Japan with Tokyo Story next week. Yasujiro Ozu movie. And it'll be the first Ozu movie I've ever seen as well. He's a very, very acclaimed director. I mean, my old Japanese movies really do begin and end with Kurosawa, and it should go further than that. Although that's actually not true. I've seen a couple of non-Kurosawa old Japanese movies. That's actually not true. But mainly it begins and ends with Kurosawa. But that is the point of It's a Wonderful Podcast, Janine. We discover new old movies. We celebrate old movies here on the main show, and we love it. Dearly. It is not the only show we have on this podcast feed, though, is it?
No, of course. We have our Wednesday show, Morgan Hasn't Seen, where I force you to watch things you haven't seen. Right now, we are talking the films of, we're going a very American route on Morgan Hasn't Seen.
Yes,
we are talking the films of all-American actor Kevin Costner. You know, we did Field of Dreams. You found a lot in that film that you enjoyed and kind of came to the realization you had quite a few Costner gaps, more than you thought. So I curated a pretty interesting, well-mixed series of Costner films that we're covering over there. So that's been really fun.
It very much has. We also, rather excitingly, have returned to Monday Madness. Season 2 is here.
Yes.
Of Monday Madness. That is particularly exciting. You can, of course, find that on the It's a Wonderful Podcast YouTube channel as well. We switched up the format a little bit there, streamlined it somewhat. Yeah. And, but fundamentally it's the same nonsense as you were used to from the original 50 episodes of Monday Madness. Monday, Wednesday, Friday, we have you covered on the It's a Wonderful Podcast feed. It's been a long time since I've said that and I've missed it.
Yeah.
I've missed it. On all major podcast platforms, of course, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Answer those little questions that we put on Spotify. What do you think of Breathless? Is it snobbish to enjoy Breathless? No, it isn't. But do you think it is? Maybe you do. That's your opinion. That's fine. I don't think it's snobbish to enjoy Breathless. We're here to tell you that you don't need to listen to those people who say it's snobbish to enjoy Breathless. It's a perfectly enjoyable movie and actually rather fun to watch. Really, really is. Go and watch it. It's exciting. It's good stuff. Subscribe. Ding the notification bell over on the It's a Wonderful Podcast YouTube channel, of course, as I've just mentioned, for Monday Madness Season 2 and all the other fun stuff we have there. Morgan hasn't seen TV as well, of course. Do you like Bridgerton? Everybody likes Bridgerton, yes. Right? Go and watch our Bridgerton things. It's great. What else, Janine? What else? With the Patreon, the donation links we spoke about before. But you can, of course, find us on the app formerly known as Twitter. At It's a Wonderful One. You can find me there at the Purple Dawn with the 3 instead of the E in there because, Janine.
3 is the magic number.
On Instagram, TikTok, and Threads at The Purple Dawn. All your Frenchy French stuff is where.
You can find me at Janine_Deveen_ on Twitter, Janine Deveen on Instagram, TikTok, and Threads. If you want to get any merch for any of our shows, just check the description for the link or search It's a Wonderful Podcast on teespring.com. And if you want to purchase any of my art in print form, you can find that at my Big Cartel shop, g9design.bigcartel.com.
Well, you've been practicing for this.
I have.
And I'm very excited.
I think I probably did it on La Belle et la Bête.
Oh, you 100% you did it on the La Belle et la Bête. You may have done it on Paris Blues as well. If I am forgetting another French movie we've done on this show, forgive me. It's been over 300 episodes and I just frankly don't remember all the movies that we've covered at one point or another on the main show. But please, Janine, in your finest French, take it away.
Toi. You. Oh.
Bye. I should have probably said
au revoir. I was going to say the same.